Hello. During my last talk, I spoke about the development of urbanism and states in the Horn of Africa, and especially on the Ethiopian plateau, where one central element seems to have been contacts and exchanges between very different populations, both within and beyond the region itself. In a sense, we can talk about the Horn of Africa as part of the eastern extension of a vast environmental zone that stretches from the Atlantic coast of Mauritania and Senegal in the west to the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, and that encompasses the grasslands and woodlands that lie south of the Sahara and the Arabian Desert. This environmental zone, which is often designated the Sahel-Sudan zone in West and Central Africa, stretches over a distance of almost 8,000 kilometers or 5,000 miles. To put this in perspective, the distance between Bordeaux in France and Shanghai in China is about 9,700 kilometers or about 6,000 miles. It's not surprising then that we have an immense amount of archaeological and historical and ethnographic and linguistic and genetic evidence for cultural interchange, population movements along this east-west belt to the south of the great deserts. And one can imagine how this would work. The bands of grassland and woodland that lie to the south of these deserts provide an east-west corridor through which populations can move, explore and occupy new territories, but retaining the agricultural systems, the economic adaptations that they already know. I now want to turn to the western edge of this environmental zone, and especially to the region known as the Inland Niger Delta in what's now Mali in West Africa and the regions around that. The Inland Niger Delta is, in many ways, geographically and environmentally, an extraordinary area. It's a region where the Niger River, flowing out of its headwaters to the southwest, expands outward into a complex network of rivers, streams, marshes. It's an area of significant agricultural potential during the growing season and of significant cultural and economical interchange. In this region, we have archaeological evidence for the importance of regional trade and exchange networks, very similar to that we found on the Ethiopian plateau and in Aksum from extremely early times. Today, this is one of the poorer parts of a poor continent. But what you need to note is that for centuries, it was one of the very richest areas in Africa. The Inland Niger Delta, this environmental zone, it's productive in its own right, especially in agricultural products. But what was also important was that it occupied an area, a territory where it could control the flow of goods from both the tropical forest zones further to the south, one of the most significant of those goods being gold, and I'll come back to that, and the goods coming across the Sahara and ultimately from North Africa to the north. So besides this east-west banding of environmental zones, one of the things we have to note is that this puts populations in an excellent position to exploit the different resource potentials of very different environmental zones further to the south and further to the north. When I say that the Inland Niger Delta is in one of the poorest parts of a poor continent, I just want to speak for a moment about the processes that made it poor, because these are quite possible to analyze and to understand. One of the main elements behind the impoverishment of this Sahelian and Sudanic zone in West and Central Africa was the capture of trans-Saharan trade routes, earlier trans-Saharan trade routes, by European traders working along the West African Atlantic coast further to the south after the 15th century AD. That term I used, I spoke about the Sudan and the Sahel. The Sahelian zone is the semi-arid environment directly south of the Sahara, directly adjacent to the southern boundaries of the Sahara Desert. So it's this extremely dry area, quite marginal for agriculture. But the meaning of the term Sahel, it's an Arab word, and it means the coast. Why would an Arab term for coast be used for the arid borderlands of the Sahara? Well, we have to think of the Sahara Desert after at least the beginning of the first millennium AD as an ocean, and the Sahel as the coast of this ocean, an ocean of sand, an ocean of rock, an ocean of desert, with the cities and towns of the Sahel, ports on that ocean, and that ocean connected West Africa and all of the resources and potentials of West Africa with North Africa and the Mediterranean basin. It was a dangerous ocean to cross in, for example, camel caravans with the scattered islands that would be the oases of the Sahara. It was dangerous, but it was also a profitable ocean to cross. Once one made it to the ports that existed along its northern and southern extremities. In the 15th century AD and onward, European traders establishing trading posts along the West African Atlantic coast, coming to the region by sea, essentially captured these trade routes. So trade began to flow south to the Atlantic Ocean instead of flowing north across the Saharan Ocean. And these areas that had been rich ports for the trans-Saharan slave trade became economic backwaters. Urban centers and states in West and Central Africa have traditionally been assumed to be gifts from the north, the result of contacts with North Africa and the Near East, probably from the late first millennium AD onward. So they're assumed to have been the result of northern inspiration, and they're assumed to be relatively late. This went along with an assumption that I mentioned in my last lecture, that African cultural advances could not have happened without external inspiration. Historians traditionally thought that trans-Saharan contacts became especially widespread and important after about the 8th century AD. And so, under this model, we would not then expect to find evidence for social and political complexity in West Africa until after that time, until the very end of the first millennium AD or the beginning of the second millennium AD. In particular, cities were supposed to be an essentially medieval and Islamic feature of the region. Excavations over the last 30 years have revealed a far more complex situation, with urbanism and states developing indigenously. At the same time, trade across the Sahara seems to be both earlier and more widespread than was previously thought. So we've underestimated, as archaeologists, I suppose, we've underestimated both the dynamism of the region and its external contacts. And the area where this process is perhaps best understood is the inland Niger Delta. After pioneering work by American, French, and Malian archaeologists from the 1970s onward, I especially want to note here work by Susan and Rod McIntosh at Rice University on the site of Jenny Jano, Old Jenny, in the inland Niger Delta. We have to interpret cultural history in this part of Africa as we did in Egypt, in the context of a desiccating Sahara, a Sahara that's drying out from the 4th millennium BC onward. Before that, areas now desert supported populations of cattle pastoralists and hunter-gatherers living along river and lake systems now utterly vanished. At this point, it today seems as if both agriculture involving cattle herding and millet cultivation and substantial settlements in this region first developed in the Southern Sahara, what's now the Southern Sahara of West Africa. We have some evidence that even pastoralist populations in the Southern Sahara, even in the 4th millennium BC, had evolved networks, had developed networks of exchange of rare and valuable artifacts, as well as building mounds over the graves of their leaders, which implies a dynamic towards greater social and political hierarchy, even at that very early time. In the Dar Tichit region of southeastern Mauritania, in an area more or less entirely desert at this point, the Sahara has taken it over. Over 90 habitation sites of varying sizes existed in a four-level settlement hierarchy between about 1500 and 500 BC in an area that's now desert. These settlement hierarchies, as well as the internal characteristics of the district and regional centers in these hierarchies, imply some degree of political centralization and control at a very early period in communities that, because of desiccation, because even at that point in the 2nd and 1st millennia BC, the Sahara was very rapidly reverting to desert. So significant environmental stress. These Dar Tichit populations seem to have been cultivating African millet. Interestingly enough, this is the same millet, the same cereal crop, that's found on the Harappan sites in Pakistan and in India a millennium earlier than that. So one of the mysteries of this region and of archaeological work in this area is how millet, how African millet got from this part of West Africa, and it was probably domesticated originally in this part of West Africa because that's where the wild ancestors of the crop still exist. How did African millet get from this part of West Africa to India and Pakistan in the 3rd millennium BC? It's likely that some sort of chiefdom existed at this site, at Dar Tichit, in the late 2nd and early 1st millennia BC, with similar political units at neighboring sites. So remember now, I've noted that this area is now desert and was drying out, was reverting to desert during this period, during the period of occupation at Dar Tichit. Conversely, areas further to the south may have been too wet to allow substantial human populations to settle during this time. The Sahara is drying out, but at the same time, rainfall levels are above those of the present day. They're falling towards present levels. Thus, in the inland Niger Delta, now one of the most fertile areas of the region, environments may have simply been too swampy to occupy in any numbers until the 1st millennium BC. So as the Southern Sahara dried out, the people living there, the populations living in what's now the Southern Sahara, were forced to move out. They were forced to migrate south into areas where cereal agriculture was becoming more feasible, as in the inland Niger Delta. And they were probably interacting with indigenous foraging populations and perhaps farming populations in these areas as well. we're going to see this same process of work in the Lake Chad Basin, where I do my archaeological research in the next lecture. This progressive mixing of populations probably was at the origin of the complex ethnic milieu that we find in the inland Niger Delta even today. One important advance in this region may have been the domestication or introduction from somewhere else in West Africa of indigenous African rice. And this is actually a different species of rice than Asian rice. It was domesticated independently in West Africa and supports large populations in the area around the inland Niger Delta today. So the period of which it was domesticated or introduced into the region would have involved a significant increase in the agricultural potential of the region. Once it began then in the first millennium BC, settlement of the inland Niger Delta seems to have happened fairly quickly. Farming communities appear in the archaeological record by the 8th century BC at sites like Jah. Other settlement sites like Jenejeno, arguably the best known of these settlement sites, begin to develop late in the last half of the first millennium BC, with complex networks of prosperous towns throughout the region by the 2nd or 3rd centuries AD. So there's a fairly rapid development of substantial populations in and around the inland Niger Delta through the first millennium BC and by the beginning of the first millennium AD. Trade was important in this region from the very beginning. The excavators, Susan and Rob McIntosh, working at Jenejeno, discovered that iron ore, stone, and copper were imported into the area from hundreds of miles away in some cases, probably using the Niger River itself for transport. In later times, gold certainly would be an extremely valuable import coming from the south. Kola nuts, a stimulant widely used in the region, again, coming from the forest zones to the south. Meat, perhaps traded from pastoral populations. Salt, coming from the Sahara, an essential import. And these inland Niger Delta sites, places like Jenejeno and Jah, acting as trading emporia and centers for the exchange of these goods. One of the most striking evidences for trade and social hierarchy in this region comes actually not from the inland Niger Delta itself, but from areas further eastward along the Niger, near the Niger, in northeastern Burkina Faso, an area where intensive archaeological research has only really been undertaken over about the last 10 to 15 years. This evidence is contemporary with the developments that I've been talking about. It dates to the middle of the first millennium AD. At the Kissi 3 site in Burkina Faso, in northeastern Burkina Faso, high status graves dating to the period between AD 400 and AD 700 yielded brass and other copper alloy anklets, cowrie shells, glass and carnelian beads, and weapons, including swords, that had been brought into the region from the southern Sahara and ultimately from North Africa and beyond. Some of these beads may come from South Asia, from the same area where thousands of years before we saw the development of a very sophisticated bead-making tradition during the Harappan period. So this Kissi 3 site has yielded artifacts, again, attesting to long-distance, far-flung networks of trade and exchange that take in not merely West Africa, but extend through significant areas of the Old World beyond that. These burials seem to have belonged to a horse-riding elite group in the region. The remains from Kissi 3 are firmly emplaced within regional cultural traditions, stretching back into the first millennium BC, and with agricultural systems like those found on contemporary West African savanna sites. The exotic goods found at KISI 3 may well have provided new and very effective ways of signaling elite status, but there's no evidence that these new social and political arrangements were introduced with trade across the desert to the north. By the mid-late first millennium AD, Jenigeno was an important urban center, probably housing more than 25,000 people at its height. These people lived in a constellation of habitation areas within a radius of about a kilometer or 0.6 miles in an urban cluster reminiscent of those in Shang, China. As in China, this settlement pattern may be a means of peacefully organizing people of different ethnic groups and different occupations in a single town. This clustering of habitation areas, I should note, this clustering of habitation areas into a single site is a fairly common pattern in the inland Niger Delta. I should also note that these sites, like Jenigeno and Ja that we find in and around the inland Niger Delta at this time, sit at the top of well-developed settlement hierarchies. There seems to be good evidence that this system has developed according to indigenous processes over time. If we go back then to these urban clusters, unlike Shang, China, and this is quite significant, unlike Shang, China, there's no real evidence for great differences in material wealth or social standing within the Jenigeno community. We found no palaces or administrative centers on the site of Jenigeno, and the burials that had been located display very few differences in the material goods that are buried with the corpse. In this respect, Jenigeno resembles a Harappan town more than it does a Shang capital, or for that matter, more than it does the cemetery at KISI 3. Rod and Susan McIntosh have suggested that the town was governed in a relatively heterarchical fashion. There, I'm using that term again, that term that I realize is less familiar to us in our own fairly hierarchical world than is the concept of hierarchy. But the sense here, again, is of a more horizontal distribution of political and social power, governance that works not so much through vertical networks of power, but through horizontal webs of relationships. Perhaps, for example, through councils of ethnic groups representing different occupational specializations. And we seem to have some archaeological evidence at Jenigeno of this differentiation, both ethnic and occupational. Again, I'll note, this is not necessarily egalitarian or democratic rule. It may involve lesser degrees of social hierarchy, but we cannot make the assumption that hierarchy did not exist. It certainly does imply different logics of governance, of rule, than existed, for example, in Shang, China. Similar centers to Jenigeno exist at other locations in and around the inland Niger Delta, at Ja, at Tongomare Diabel. It's not clear, however, that all of these towns were organized according to the political template that seems to have been in use at Jenigeno. And in fact, there may have been considerable variation in political systems around the inland Niger Delta during the first millennium AD. I will note that, for example, we have no evidence of a large territorial state in this area at this time. There's no evidence for that at all. These seem to be relatively independent urban communities. This variability, this diversity, is also suggested by the Kissi III burials. However, the archaeological data do strongly indicate quite high population densities and really urban ways of life in and around the inland Niger Delta through the first millennium AD. There are similarities in pottery and in other artifact types, particularly terracotta figurines found on different sites, that indicate cultural contacts over a large area. And we can possibly, I think, speak about a civilization in this area during this period, akin to that we've seen in other areas of the world, but distinctively West African, and certainly far more than some pallid copy of what was going on in North Africa at the time. These sites are too early to plausibly be ascribed to foreign influence. More importantly, and as a Kissi, developments at Jenny Jano, at Jah, at these other sites, these developments in urbanism and economic and political relations are rooted in West African cultural logic and not North African ones. Islamic travelers in West Africa frequently express surprise and shock at the foreign characteristics of the communities they visited, which would be unlikely if these societies had developed according to North African Islamic norms. Nevertheless, inland Niger Delta centers were trading widely through the first and early second millennia AD. They had contacts with these other areas. There's ample evidence that they were obtaining gold from forest zones to the south and the southwest, and they were trading it northward across the Sahara. Indeed, medieval Europe's monetary system depended to a very great extent on West African gold funneled through Jenny Jano, through Gao, and through other sites. Ivory and slaves were probably also substantial exports, while salt from the Sahara, horses, and a whole variety of manufactured and luxury goods from the Mediterranean were imported into West Africa in return. In some ways, developments around the inland Niger Delta resemble those in Southeast Asia. Increases in population densities and social and political scale seem to accompany innovations in agricultural systems, the farming of millet and African rice, for example, and the extension of trading networks. There even exists in both areas controversy about the role of better-known external states. But in both areas, more recent research has revealed the important indigenous element in cultural innovation and change in these areas. Jenny Jano seems to have declined in importance early in the second millennium AD. There's evidence for defensive wall construction, which hadn't existed before that, and political contacts with North Africa appear. And the site was abandoned by about AD 1400. By that time, West Africa, or at least this part of West Africa, was well into a period of dominance by expansive militaristic states. And the millennium-long experiment with more heterarchic urban forms at Jenny Jano, if such it was, seems to have ended. These states, these expansionistic states, the best known being Ghana and Mali in their pre-colonial forms and Songhai, would dominate the history of Sudanic and Sahelian West Africa through the first half of the second millennium AD. In my next talk, we'll move to another area along this great Sudanic Sahelian belt running south of the Sahara to the Lake Chad Basin and to the area where I work. Thank you.